From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, we look at the recent turmoil between the Kansas City Museum and Union Station.
They had worked on this plan that had called for basically the separation of the two entities, saying it would be best for the Kansas City Museum going forward.
Travel to the Galapagos with two St. Louis scientists, and one Kansan defends her love for the Wizard of Oz.
There is no other state in America that has an association that people feel good about all over the world.
Plus, a basement department brings together one couple, the next in our series on Kansas City's creative couples.
Because we're a couple, we automatically thought that, like, oh, we'll do it together. And it just absolutely did not work.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
It came as a shock to a lot of people when Kansas City Museum Director Christopher Leach was let go last month by the management of Union Station. The two institutions merged back in 2000, but it's been a rocky relationship. And now it's really unclear what the future will be for both institutions. KCUR arts reporter Laura Spencer has been following the fallout from the departure of the museum's director. She joins us today on Casey Currents to explain what's happened. Thanks for stopping by.
You're welcome.
So did you ever go to the Kansas City Museum as a kid?
I did. I grew up in the area, and I remember going there on field trips and also with my grandmother. And it was always a fun place to visit. They had this terrific igloo that you could go inside, and also the animal dioramas. But one of the real highlights was an old-timey soda fountain that you could stop. It was from 1910, and it did actually serve up different sodas. It's a fun place to go.
And it is kind of a quirky museum, right?
You know, as a child going there, you're going into this grand home. But then the way that it used to be, you'd go inside and they'd have different exhibits set up about the history of the area. But yeah, I guess there's some quirky things about some of the artifacts in the collection. Quite a bit of the collection of the Kansas City Museum is either costumes. It's known for its Native American artifacts. So maybe not things that you normally think of in a museum, if you think of kind of garments that were manufactured here in the Kansas City area.
And as far as a lot of people are concerned, the museum has been closed for the past few years because it's undergoing renovation. Is that right?
Well, it's interesting. Christopher Leach, the director who is now the former director of the Kansas City Museum, was on. I hosted Central Standard a while back, and I did say, and the museum has been closed. And he quickly corrected me and said it's not closed. It has been open. But I do think a lot of people think of it as closed because so much of the museum is not available as they've undergone renovations. Since about 2008, when they started really, you know, redoing the interior, much of the museum has been closed. But I think that museum officials have said, no, the museum has never closed, because some of the artifacts have been, through their community curator program, have been on display in different parts of the metro area. But you could say that most of the building has been closed to the public.
And of course, it's in this beautiful old mansion in the Northeast. That's a historic mansion.
That's right.
Does anyone know why the director, Christopher Leach, was fired?
I think it did come as a surprise. The Kansas City Museum Advisory Board, which is a group of folks who are appointed by the mayor, it's community members as well as city council people. They met on a Monday almost a month ago and were notified by George Guastella, who's the CEO and president of Union Station, that Christopher Leach had been fired. But I think it was a surprise to everyone, and I think to the Museum Advisory Board as well as to the community.
And his departure coincided with plans by that advisory board to start talking about a separation from Union Station. Where is that idea coming from?
Well, I think that idea has been in the works for quite a while. I think that there have been people who've discussed that idea ever since the merging of the two entities. I know that it came up in about 2006, right before the most recent contract was hammered out in 2007. And then, again, talks have come about that Kansas City Museum Advisory Board was working on a plan. I think that it was dated the day before the Museum Advisory Board meeting. They had worked on this plan that had called for basically the separation of the two entities, saying it would be best for the Kansas City Museum going forward to be separate from Union Station.
Why did that plan state that it would be best for the museum to be separate?
This plan was a combination of different strategic plans and different proposals that had been all combined together in this business plan. And the folks who co-wrote this included city officials. But the thrust of it was that the separation between the Kansas City Museum and Union Station would be beneficial to the Kansas City Museum for a number of reasons, including the fact that the Kansas City Museum would be able to regain its accreditation, possibly, if it was separate from Union Station, and also have other sources of funding if it was separate from Union Station. These talks have been going on for quite some time.
What was the Union Station's reaction to the idea of separation?
Well, it's interesting. I have not actually been able to speak to the folks from Union Station directly. Actually, I played phone tag with the CFO. But from what I've understood and from what has been communicated through press releases and news releases, they are open to the idea of separation, although it sounds like they want more information about what that would entail. But at one point, there were rumors going around that Union Station would be closing the Kansas City Museum, that the firing of Christopher Leach was the signaling that that was their intentions for the Kansas City Museum to close it down. But the Union Station officials have said that wasn't their intention.
The city was supposed to start an audit of Union Station in January. What's the status of that audit?
The city council called for an audit of Union Station and its management of the Kansas City Museum in January. A scope statement was supposed to be submitted in committee in March, and that hasn't happened. And it's now August, and as of recently, City Councilwoman Jan Markison asked for a delay in even submitting the scope statement. And the scope statement would basically create milestones for the audit. So the city councilwoman said that she thought there'd be more discussions and that she wanted there to be a more congenial relationship between Union Station and Kansas City Museum. And it sounded like she thought having the audit being discussed right now might kind of create some tensions. So it sounds like that will be discussed again after Labor Day.
And if the two institutions were to separate, I understand there's some confusion now about which institution would get different parts of the collection.
That's right. As part of the most recent contract, which was signed in 2007, Union Station has been managing the collection of the Kansas City Museum, and the city owns Kansas City Museum. But that most recent contract separated the collection so that the city owns Kansas City Museum's collection from 1970 and before, and then Union Station owns the collection after that date. So the way the contract was stated, Union Station owns a majority of the collection. So I think that there are going to be a lot more discussions about the future of the collection, because there are a lot of artifacts that I'm sure the museum would want to retain in its collection if the two entities were separated.
What's going to be the next step here?
Well, the Kansas City Museum Advisory Board holds a monthly meeting. Last month, it was when the director, Christopher Leach, it was announced that he was fired. There will be another meeting on Monday, and I would assume there might be some updates on next steps. I know the city officials haven't really talked about yet what the next steps are.
And who will make the final decision, really?
Well, Union Station recently had a press release basically saying that the city would be the one to take kind of the next steps. So I think there'll be a number of conversations that continue, but next steps are unclear.
Well, Laura Spencer is the arts reporter here at KCUR. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
One in five adults over age 15 is a member of a cooperative, according to the United Nations. That's 1 billion people worldwide. And the UN says co-ops will be the fastest growing business model by the year 2025. But here in the U.S., the number of co-ops have been steadily declining, down 40% from 1993. Reporting from Nebraska for Harvest Public Media, Hillary Stowes Krause finds that the co-op model, long a staple of Midwestern agricultural communities, is being redefined in ways big and small.
Basically, everything you see is as new as a almost 100-year-old building can be. One of the things that we did save is the tin ceiling.
Elwood is a town of 700 people in south-central Nebraska. Charlotte Schwenninger gives me a tour of the town's new cooperative grocery store.
I get very emotional almost every time I'm in here because I'm just so happy to have this store. And I think it's something that we're going to be proud of for a long time.
The store is an example of how the cooperative, or co-op, business model is being adapted in rural communities.
There's this variety, like you said, the grocery stores, and then there's the worker co-ops, and ag co-ops, and marketing co-ops, and credit unions are cooperatives. Typically, the bottom line is that it's member-owned, member-controlled, member-benefited.
Co-ops are businesses owned by community members, who pay a membership fee and in return receive financial benefits and voting power, she says. They've been around in the U.S. since 1752, mostly in agriculture. Today, one-third of the nation's top 100 largest cooperatives can be found in the five-state region of Nebraska, South Dakota, Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In 1993, 848 ag-related cooperatives operated in the region. By 2007, that number had been cut almost in half.
What has happened is cooperatives have converged to make them competitive in the world market.
That's Ed Wobble with the Nebraska Cooperative Council. He shows me a map of ag co-ops in Nebraska, and it's covered with what look like neurons, or maybe fireworks, central dots showing the co-op's headquarters with lines that stretch outward in every direction to indicate local branches. The 39 co-ops that belong to the council operate in 352 locations. But as ag co-ops have gone global, other hyper-local co-ops, like the Elwood Grocery Store, have been springing up in greater numbers as rural populations age.
Hi, Marvin.
Hi. Can we get something?
Take Wallback, a bedroom community in north-central Nebraska who gave the co-op model a try when the town grocery store announced it was closing.
We had high hopes for it.
That's Mina Sprague, one of the founding members of Frogs, or First Rural Organic Grocery Store. The co-op opened in January of 2011. Earlier this year, it shut down.
And we're sad, but it's kind of a relief not to have to worry about who's working and who's covering the store.
Frogs succumbed to two big challenges common to retail co-ops, especially in small towns and rural areas. Their plan relied heavily on volunteerism, but as the town's initial enthusiasm slowly died off, the board members found themselves putting in more and more hours. There was also the issue of competition with stores in surrounding communities, says fellow board member Dave Sprague. In particular, a city 40 miles south, where much of Wallback's population already travels for work.
And once you're down there for 8 hours, well, you might as well shop there. And we cannot compete with Walmart.
Back in Elwood, Schwenninger says they tried to break habits of shopping in nearby, bigger Lexington by focusing on the economic benefits to the local community.
If they spend money in Elwood, it, 54 cents out of every dollar stays in town. If we shop in Lexington, 15 cents out of every dollar stays in Lexington, and none of it comes to Elwood.
Additionally, Schwenninger says since the cost and risk of buying and remodeling the store was spread across a wide group of people, the rewards will be spread across the community too.
Because we were pooling money, we were able to do it right. That's kind of what the beauty of a cooperative in a small town is.
The Elwood Co-op has only been open a few months, and there are still challenges. But Schwenninger says she has faith the community will work together to make it successful. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Hilary Stose Krause.
Up a trip to the Galapagos with two young scientists from St. Louis. You're listening to KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
Charles Darwin revolutionized science. His theory of evolution was based on careful observations of birds and other wildlife in places like the Galapagos Islands. But one thing that has really been slow to evolve is the gender mix in science. Men still dominate many scientific fields, just like they did in Darwin's day more than 150 years ago. But gradually, more women are breaking in. We're going to meet up with two young women scientists from Missouri, at least in part. But where do we find them? Where else? The Galapagos. Veronique LaCapra is our guide.
I'm Veronique, and this is Mari.
Mi nombre es Maricruz Jaramillo, y soy de Quito, Ecuador.
Mari Cruz Jaramillo grew up in Ecuador's capital, Quito, but she always loved being out in nature.
When I look at pictures of myself when I was little, I always see, like, I have a really happy face when I'm outside. I don't know, maybe I associated it with spending time with my family and my dad. Then I could just run and I would pick up stuff from the ground. And I just really love being outdoors.
I was pretty much the same way. I brought my mom home tadpoles, caterpillars, earthworms, and eventually a PhD in ecology and evolution. Mari's getting hers now from the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And she's doing fieldwork in the one place I think every ecologist wants to go.
Ever since I knew I wanted to be a biologist, I wanted to come to the Galapagos Islands. That was my goal. And my dream, too.
But they're not easy to get to. The Galapagos Islands are in the Pacific, 600 miles west of Ecuador. From St. Louis, it took me 2 days, 3 flights, a ferry ride, and 45 minutes in a pickup truck to get there. Charles Darwin took a ship, the HMS Beagle. He was only 26 when he visited the Galapagos, about Mari's age. What he saw changed his life and the history of science. Most of the wildlife that lives on these volcanic mounds is found nowhere else in the world. Giant tortoises, marine iguanas, and those little sparrow-like birds known as Darwin's finches. Mari first made it to the Galapagos 5 years ago. She's back again, studying a kind of malaria that's infecting birds here. In Hawaii, avian malaria has driven many native bird species to extinction. That hasn't happened in the Galapagos, but Mari and other scientists are trying to gauge the threat.
It's 5:30 in the morning, and it's just barely starting to get light in the sky. I'm meeting the researchers who are going to be setting up some mist nets to catch birds.
Who wants to set another net?
Mist nets look sort of like volleyball nets, but around twice as high and reaching almost to the ground. Their mesh is nearly invisible. The birds fly right into it and get snagged. Mari and the others work quickly to untangle them.
When you have a bird in your hand, it's just really warm and soft, and you can feel its really fast heartbeat. And you just know that you're holding something really fragile.
Each bird gets weighed and measured.
This one's 45 grams.
Mari, or one of her helpers, takes a small blood sample to test later for malaria. Then they release the bird again.
This little one is ready to go.
Lau Ladagu na Samoa Asigao, buna lau na Papua New Guinea kekenina.
Samoa Asigao speaks Motu, along with Pidgin and English, among the many languages in her country, Papua New Guinea. It's an island nation just north of Australia. Samoa met Mari in graduate school in St. Louis. She's in the Galapagos, trying to help solve a different piece of the avian malaria puzzle. Which species of mosquito is transmitting the parasite from bird to bird? Just before dusk, Samoa sets out her traps.
The thing about trapping mosquitoes is you have to think like a mosquito.
Female mosquitoes, they're the ones that bite and can spread disease, like to lay their eggs in stagnant water. So Samoa mixes up a smelly brew for her traps.
Every time I pour this water, in my mind I'm like thinking like, mosquitoes, please come, come to it. So I can trap more mosquitoes in the morning. Seriously, that's what I do every time. Oh, it smells good, right?
Actually, it smells like rancid gym socks. The smellier the water, the more mosquitoes she'll get and be able to dissect. Working with a microscope, delicate tools, and very steady hands, she'll chop off their tiny heads and extract their salivary glands to look for the malaria parasite. Samoa has stared at so many mosquitoes so close up, she has started to appreciate them, especially a species called Aedes aegypti.
It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. It's covered in these black and white bands all over its legs, all over its abdomen, its face, and yeah, the first time I saw it under a microscope, I kind of fell in love with it. In a weird way.
Samoa says her parents encouraged her to get an education and pursue a career in science. But she says most people in Papua New Guinea hold strongly to traditional beliefs and gender roles.
And just growing up and looking around and seeing the opportunities that were given to males rather than females, that sort of placed an aggression in me, good aggression. It told me that, hey, why do males always have to get chosen over females?
For Samoa, becoming a scientist started out as a way to prove herself. But eventually, it became more than that.
I realized that, no, science was something that I really wanted to do.
Once she gets her PhD, Samoa wants to return to Papua New Guinea to help protect wildlife there. And she hopes to be a role model and train a new generation of female scientists.
Empower young girls, empower women, and tell them, you know, if I can come from a country like Papua New Guinea, come and do research in a place like Galapagos and study at an institution like my university, then you can do it too.
Her friend Mari plans to keep doing research in her home country of Ecuador, maybe in the Galapagos Islands.
I don't know exactly if I would enjoy my life as much if I wasn't a scientist.
Sometimes, though, Mari thinks about all the hard work and long hours.
But then I realized, like, what else would I be doing? I wouldn't be enjoying it as much if I was doing something else. So it's my way of life. It's essentially what I am, I think.
I'm Veronique LaCapra.
This story was produced for the PRX STEM Story Project with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. If you can't listen to all of Casey Kearns today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
She fell from the sky, she fell very far, and Kansas, she says, is the name of the star.
Kansas, she says, is the name of the star.
Love it or hate it, the 1939 movie The Wizard of Oz established Kansas on the global map. And if you're from Kansas, or even from Kansas City, Missouri, no matter where you go in the world, someone's got a crack to make about Dorothy, or Toto. Or how about this witty remark? You're not in Kansas anymore, are you? The Hollywood blockbuster that came out earlier this year, Oz the Great and Powerful, brought it all back. The movie told the backstory of the wizard, who also happened to hail from the Sunflower State.
Step this way! See the most wondrous sights imaginable!
Kansas is full of good men. I don't want to be a good man. I want to be a great one.
Not everyone here locally is trying to escape the legacy of the Wizard of Oz. Joining us now is one Kansan who can't get enough Oz in her life. Jane Albright is the director of the International Wizard of Oz Fan Club. But she got into it as a kid. We spoke to her back in March.
I grew up in Topeka, Kansas, in a house that had a shelf of Oz books. The Wizard of Oz is the first in a series of books that eventually grew to be 40 titles, and I wanted to read all the books. I had to borrow them from neighbors and acquire them over the years. That turned me into a collector. In college, I won a book collecting contest, and people began asking me questions about Oz as a piece of literature, or about the biographer, or about the MGM film. And I usually didn't know the answers. So at that point, I started reading the reference books and the biographies and material about Oz until now, here I am 30 years later, just fully immersed.
So now you're a total Oz expert, I would say.
Well, there are people who are published whose expertise I would bow to in a heartbeat. But I do know an awful lot about Oz.
International Oz Club. Now, what, pray tell, does it do?
The International Wizard of Oz Club was founded back in 1957 by a teenage boy who collected Oz books. And he approached other people who he knew were interested in Oz, primarily from fan mail that had written to the man who was writing Oz books at the time, and an exhibit that was mounted at the Columbia Library. And he wrote everyone who was interested and asked, do you want to join an Oz Club? And he rounded up 20 or so people, and now, 50 years later, we are more like 1,000 people. It's a nonprofit educational organization. We publish a very credible journal, The Bomb Bugle, and meet annually, publish rare and unusual Oz material that we make available for sale.
Now, where is the organization based out of?
We do have an office in San Francisco, but we are a volunteer, entirely volunteer-run organization. So everyone who contributes is working out of their own homes all over the country.
So is there a local Oz Club, too?
There is not. In fact, with Oz the Great and Powerful coming out, I emailed all of the members I could find in the greater Kansas City, if you stretch that up to the edge of Oklahoma and into Kansas area. And there were only about 20 of us right around here. 6 of us went to see the film together the opening night.
So you mentioned that this has been, you know, a long time passion for you. Why do you care about the story of Oz so much? Are there themes that mean a lot to you?
The book of The Wizard of Oz is not presented as a dream. Oz is a real place. So the subsequent books in the series create a very strong, growing sense of place as more and more characters and activities and adventures take place there. As a young reader, I wanted to go to Oz. It was a very real place to me. But obviously, I outgrew that when I was in college, and that's kind of when I shifted over to being more of a collector. Now it's this incredible network of people that I know all over the country, all over the world, who love Oz, and being connected and networked with them is incredibly satisfying. I really have great fun as a collector, finding and acquiring things that I've looked for years, or finding things that other people I know want and directing them to pick them up is really fun and satisfying.
So you mentioned the members. What lengths do these members go to express their devotion to Oz?
I know people who have purchased a second home to house their Oz collection. 2 or 3 individuals whose collections are so massive that they've been able to open private museums. There are people who appear in character regularly, and that's the way they express their interest. Gosh, a number of Oz fans write their own original fan fiction or do a lot of artwork, illustration, either for books or just as freestanding fine art. There's really no limits.
Now, you mentioned earlier that a lot of Oz fans collect memorabilia and that you have a collection. So tell me about it.
My collection fills the third floor of my home in Hyde Park. I had to eventually divide up the space to where I have sort of a library area, which is 5 or 6 floor-to-ceiling bookcases filled with Oz books, other books the authors wrote under their own or pseudonyms, other names, books illustrated by the illustrators of Oz, international translations. I have hundreds of international foreign language translations, a lot of material from Wicked, the phenomenally successful stage musical, and the original book by Gregory Maguire. Another corner, if you will, of the floor is taken over with toys, games, dolls, housewares, children's furniture. I have probably a dozen file cabinets, glass cases loaded with ephemera, a life-size Wicked Witch, you know, that I picked up last Halloween at a Spirit Halloween store, stands in a corner, and when I turn her on, she talks to you if you walk in front of her. It's crazy. My rarest and most unusual things are generally books, and describing them takes a long time because you have to understand the context to appreciate their interest. The more general Oz fan who walks in is usually most interested to see. I have bars of Over the Rainbow handwritten by Harold Arlen on a piece of paper that I'm just thrilled to have that particular piece. I have a lot of merchandise that was released with the 1939 film. Dolls, figural soaps, Valentines, paper masks, some things that are particularly scarce and other things that are probably not so much. I have a wonderful little collapsible cup. You know, those little, they look like a pillbox, but then you expand them up. For the 200th performance of The Wizard of Oz on Broadway in 1903, everyone in the audience was given one of these little collapsible cups with the fact that it was The Wizard of Oz 200th performance engraved on the bottom. And I have that little cup in its original box.
Let's turn to the new movie.
Oz the Great and Powerful.
Oz the Great and Powerful. So I take it you've seen it more than once.
I've seen it twice.
And what do you think? Do you think it really is true to the spirit of the original movie? Or
nearly everyone asks that question. And the MGM movie, the classic one you're referring to with Judy Garland, is one of maybe 40 Wizard of Oz movies that have been made since the earliest one appeared in 1910. So for a collector like me, I don't think so much of The Great and Powerful compared to the MGM film as The Great and Powerful compared to a much larger idea of what Oz is. I think it's children will like it, and I think that's what would have mattered most to the author. It's certainly not L. Frank Baum's vision of Oz. It's not exactly MGM's vision of Oz, but then neither's Wicked. It's a wonderfully fun film. It does do a lot of homage to the MGM movie, starting in black and white. He gets caught in a tornado. He follows the yellow brick road. He has to kill a witch. Things that only appeared in the very first Oz book, so, and in the MGM film. But, you know, it's completely its own story. And I think people need to go to it open-minded and look at it that way and just be able to enjoy it for what it is. The scenery's beautiful. What people can do now with, oh, those beautiful character-generated animations and sequences. We've never had a film that could do that before, and it's really lovely to see Oz come to life with all that color and magic.
So, you know, when you think about people who live in Kansas and the jokes that they endure about being in Kansas, certainly The Wizard of Oz is one of the jokes that people will say, oh, you know, where's Dorothy and Toto if mm-hmm. you live in Kansas? So do you think Kansans and Kansas Cityans might have the opposite reaction to The Wizard of Oz, that, you know, well, maybe they can't stand to hear anything about it, or they think it's a stereotype of where they live?
That's certainly a legitimate reaction a lot of people could feel, depending on how they feel about Oz. From my perspective, Dorothy considered being from Kansas a wonderful thing. In one of the later Oz books, a princess asks her if she is of royal blood, and she says, oh, no, better than that, I'm from Kansas. She loved being from Kansas, and it was not described in the sort of negative sense that people attributed to the Depression era 1930s Kansas that was depicted in the MGM film. So that's part of that. And the other thing is just what you said, wherever you go, anywhere, you say you're from Kansas and people say Dorothy. Mm-hmm. There is no other state in America that has an association that people feel good about all over the world. The Wizard of Oz has been translated into literally every language. There's a whole series of Oz books in Russia where Ellie and her little dog Tatoshka are as well-known as Dorothy and Toto are here. It's been a live-action film in Turkey. There are animated movies in Japan. Everywhere, people know Oz, and they know Kansas. You know, I just don't know what would happen if you were running around most of the countries of the world and said you were from where? Tennessee, West Virginia, Idaho? There's just not that strong and positive and smiling a response as we Kansans get.
So now I have to ask you, in terms of your friends and your circle and your family, do they ever say to you, Jane, enough about Oz already?
All the time. I often say when I'm asked to talk about Oz, thank you, because I'm usually asked to stop talking about Oz. I do contain the Oz collection on the third floor. I'm not one of these collectors who, if you go into my kitchen and open the cupboard doors, all the, you know, glasses or jelly glasses with Wizard of Oz on them. And I don't have Oz artwork all over the walls outside the third floor. So I managed to kind of contain it that way. My husband does prefer that I not piggyback family vacations on Oz events that I want to attend. We'd kind of like to separate those. Which is only hard because I have really dear friends all over the country, and wherever I am, I want to go see them. So sometimes there's a little bit of a juggle there. My daughter doesn't connect with my love of Oz particularly. She certainly appreciates some of our good friends, people we've vacationed with and know well. But I'm definitely the only one in my family who is as smitten with Oz as I am.
Well, thank you for being with us on Casey Kearns.
My pleasure. I'll be happy to be here anytime.
Jane Albright is a director of the International Wizard of Oz Fan Club. See photos of her extensive collection of Oz memorabilia at the website kcur.org. Click on Arts and Culture.
After the break, the next in our Creative Couples series are the curators of the Subterranean Gallery in Midtown. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. This month on Casey Currents, we've been talking to some of Kansas City's most creative couples. It's a series inspired by the work of iconic Mexican artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, which is on display this summer at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Kahlo and Rivera have a famously tempestuous relationship, which sometimes inspired their art. Our next couple graduated from the Kansas City Art Institute and opened the Subterranean Gallery in the basement of a building in Hyde Park. The gallery doubles as their apartment and has played a big role in their relationship. As Ayla Rexroth and Clayton Skidmore have showcased the work of other local artists and hosted events and exhibitions, they've had a few adventures of their own in their 7 years together. KCUR's Sangeeta Shastri has this story.
8 minutes into my conversation with Ayla Rexroth and Clayton Skidmore, the lights go out. Everything's dark.
Oh, we blew a fuse.
Hold on 1 second.
Sure. During the very middle part of the day, that's been happening.
We're sitting in Subterranean Gallery, the room just out front of the space that Ayla and Clayton share.
In the belly of the building, you end up managing everybody else's like heat and air conditioning and making all of their gas meter guy appointments. It's just much more public than we thought it would be. There's just constantly people in and out of here.
Clayton's art is hanging on the walls. He works on collages, and the ones here are everything from small foot-by-foot squares to others that almost take up the width of an entire wall.
It's a sampling of a larger world and taking in and reproducing it and reconfiguring it into something of my own fantasy, of my own interest.
Light illuminates the pieces and reflects off the painted rock walls. But this white space definitely isn't what it looked like a few years ago, Ayla says.
This place was really terrible when I moved in. It was an awful place to be, and I knew I was taking on something that was much bigger than who I was at the time.
They worked for 3 years to fix up the raw, unfinished lower level of the century-old building on Warwick Boulevard.
We would pull down pieces of the ceiling, and we'd think we were pulling off a little chunk, and then the whole thing would just slam onto the floor, and we'd have like mushroom clouds of black dirt.
Clayton raised his eyebrows at the project at first, but with every show, Ayla pocketed enough money to put up one drywall at a time. She and Clayton painted the original rock wall white and borrowed a vacuum cleaner to soak up what Clayton called a little lake in the gallery space.
Ayla has such an amazing will, and everyone was so surprised the first time they saw the clean walls in the basement. Those early years working on the gallery were really very exciting in a lot of ways because you were seeing the immediate transformations of this really like dirty, dingy place into something that was a little more.
Ayla and Clayton have both always known that art would be a big part of their lives. They graduated from the Kansas City Art Institute with painting degrees, Clayton in 2009 and Ayla the next year. And the building on Warwick has been a focal point in their lives for a while.
It's funny because we met just literally next door in the apartment next door and have been living in this little complex of apartments for 7 years.
Yeah. we kind of became adults together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They say there's virtually no line between their personal lives and their work.
Some people have religion, we have art.
We never stop talking about art. It can be in a bar over a couple of drinks.
It should be in a bar.
It could be like laying on the couch and we're both drained of all energy and we're talking about what's in front of us and analyzing it.
A perfect example of that was an event called the Hot Tub Dialogues. Ayla and Clayton say it was the biggest collaboration of their time living and working together at the Subterranean Gallery.
We co-curated that and basically organized the entire event together. That was the first time we ever worked together so intensely, and we learned a lot from doing that.
Basically, it was a lecture series with a hot tub, a bar, and a band squeezed into the small space for one night. They launched a campaign on the crowdfunding site Kickstarter, and they raised $2,700 to make their project a reality. Ayla and Clayton invited speakers they really looked up to, handed everyone some drinks and some bathrobes, put the speakers in the filled tub, and then they talked art. It started out as a joke, Clayton said, but when a friend offered up his parents' old hot tub, and when it later ended up taking over a lot of the small gallery, Ayla and Clayton were committed, but it wasn't easy.
So we ended up finding out that we had to really separate out what tasks went to what person, which is totally common sense for any business. But because we're a couple, we automatically thought that like, oh, we'll do it together. And it just absolutely did not work.
Despite the challenges, the event was a big success.
We also sold out of tickets in 4 days. It told us that our value in the community was something that we hadn't anticipated at all.
And that's why it's going to be hard for Kansas City's art community to say goodbye to Ayla and Clayton. They're moving to New York City this month so Ayla can pursue her MFA at Hunter College. On the rooftop of a friend's apartment building downtown, there was one last get-together.
Okay, yeah. No, I've seen a lot of your stuff. I really like your work.
We'll be moving out to New York in a minivan with all of our stuff and our art with us. And I'm excited to be back in a studio environment. Partially because I just feel like I really want something new to react to, and I feel like my work is so heavily reliant on what's directly around me.
Clayton's looking for formal training, too. He's thinking about going to grad school himself, but for now, he's on the lookout for an artist he might work with in New York, and he has some leads about framing jobs.
I know what I want to be, and I know I want to be an artist, and I want to figure out ways of doing that. And this year, I'm getting more and more practice with that, and I've had some major successes this year with my own art practice here, and I want to see how I can apply what I've learned to New York City.
The future is still uncertain. A degree in art doesn't ensure anything, Ayla and Clayton say. But the couple knows that having each other makes it easier.
All I know is that I know how to apply what I've learned, and I feel like that's manifested here in the gallery, but it's just not a guarantee. So it's kind of like you're in this uneasy place together, and that kind of helps.
Now, Subterranean Gallery will be in the hands of Melanie Mitchell, another graduate of the Kansas City Art Institute. She interned with the gallery while she was in school, and she was at the party to say goodbye. Like her predecessors, she'll inherit the apartment, too. She moved in August 1st. For Casey Currents, I'm Sangeeta Shastri.
See photos of Ayla Rexroth and Clayton Skidmore in their home and at work, and find more stories of Kansas City's creative couples on our website, kcur.org.
Thank you.
The very first World Choral Fest was held last month in Ireland, and it was the brainchild of a Kansas City choir director. Tracy Resige heads the choir program at Staley High School in the North Kansas City School District, and he thinks it may have been the first time, that he knows of, that singers from several different parts of the world rehearsed and performed together in a concert like this. Resige first got the idea for the festival after commissioning a choral piece about his great-grandfather, who immigrated from Norway to Iowa in 1890. He led a group of singers who performed the piece in a Norwegian church where his great-grandfather was baptized. That experience inspired him to create this intergenerational, international event in Ireland.
You know, we learn so much about each other when we're singing together that it would be a really powerful event to bring people together from different countries and live together for a week, rehearse together all week, you know, culminating in this beautiful concert.
17 of the singers who went to Ireland for the World Choral Fest were from Kansas City. This year also happens to be the Year of the Gathering. Ireland is calling Irish families back to the island to celebrate their common culture. Many of the singers who traveled there took the time to celebrate their own heritage. The group even had a reception with the Lord Mayor of Dublin, who attended the concert that marked the culmination of the festival. We're ending today's show listening to the final piece in that concert. It was the world premiere of Cantate Canticum Novum, composed by Dan Forrest, a KU grad, by the way, with lyrics by Tony Silvestri, who is a Lawrence resident. The world premiere of Cantate Canticum Novum by Dan Forrest and Tony Silvestri, performed 2 weeks ago at the World Choral Fest in Dublin. The festival was organized by Tracy Resige, choir director at Staley High School in North Kansas City.
We thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
Hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our intern is Monica Sandretsky, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.